Okay, Erev Tov, good evening everybody. We're this evening learning. I always claim everything here is famous, but this is probably famous of the famous. The Judgment of Solomon. This afternoon I was Googling the Judgment of Solomon just out of interest to see what I come up with. So there's a whole page of illustrations. So just tell you a funny story. I put one of those as wallpaper, on your computer. Judgment of Solomon as a wallpaper. So my non-Jewish colleague there, who really is a smart guy and he knows Bible, he says to me, Rabbi, he says, have you got a big decision to make? So I said, why do you ask that? He says, because you've got a picture of the Judgment of Solomon on your computer. You must have a really big decision to make. So I thought, that's very interesting, the way he understood it. I said, no, I'm just giving a lecture about it, but not exactly caught in the Judgment of Solomon, thank God. But I was kind of impressed that he had kind of an awareness. So, there are many, many Bible stories that the non-Jewish world is not aware of, but this one they really do know. And it comes up again and again, and I think on the list, the Google list, there was even a TV show called The Judgment of Solomon, which was a modern adaptation of that kind of conflict, that kind of dilemma. It's very well known. And my feeling about it is, obviously we'll go through the text and try and sort of make head or tail of what's going on here. And I want to give it a Jewish slant, because the reality is that it's not, on the surface, a decision which we would expect a Rosh Yeshiva or an Av Beis Din to come to. It doesn't sort of come out as being the obvious decision to make in the circumstance. And really, as I mentioned last week, the question which is raised, which I think is very valid, is that if Shlomo HaMelech is the quintessential rabbinic leader of the time, somebody who embodies the Chochmat HaTorah, then why is this decision made, which doesn't necessarily follow anything that you'll find remotely in Torah Shebichtav or Torah Shebaal Peh? It just doesn't appear. The whole concept of what he suggests to be done in this case. So it's very odd and it's very intriguing and kind of interesting why Shlomo did not employ the obvious halachic decision which could be made, which is a principle in Gemara, which we spoke about, mentioned already, Motzi Mechaver Alavaraya. The basic decision is, or the basic case is, two people holding on to a talit, as the Gemara says in Bava Tzia. You're both holding on to the same article. You're pulling one way, he's pulling the other way. So the Gemara says in such a case, that case is Yachloku. You have to divide the value of the article. If one person's holding the article, the other person claims that it's his, then the rule is, if you want to extract it, Reuven wants to extract it from Shimon, then Reuven has to bring proof. Alavarai has to bring a proof that it's his. A receipt, something to prove that this article is his. Otherwise, possession, as they say, is 9/10 of the law. Yes?
As you recall this dilemma, facing,
yes.
It's obvious to me why Shlomo HaMelech is judging. Because any normal person would have said, Amotim Chavera, that means there is no judgment. I can't judge.
You can't judge. It becomes a stalemate.
He has the wisdom to decide. That's the beauty of this.
Right, right. It goes beyond the halacha.
He doesn't need Amotim Chavera. Right.
He can decide who is. It's interesting that, of course, the argument, the rabbinic argument, is to say slightly different to what you've said. Not that it goes beyond, but in fact, Motzi Mechaver Alavaraya won't apply here. But of course, the question is why not? So that's the body of what we're going to be talking about. Okay, it's kind of trying to make it into a bit of a Lom D'Shashir, if possible, because it's kind of an interesting topic. Let's see the Pesukim first. I think it's page, where are we on? Page 21? Is it 21 at the bottom there? Verse 16. Pasuk Tet Zayin in the Red Book, page 35. So we're right in the middle here. We just saw Shlomo being granted this tremendous blessing of wisdom, and the Radak points out straight away. Those you have the Radak. The Pasuk Tet Zayin starts off Oz Tavona. Then came Tava Oz, like Oz Yashir, Oz Yadaber. It's an expression which you find at a kind of crucial moment. A moment of proof, like Az Yashir Moshe, they just crossed over the Red Sea, and then Moses sang, all right? And this Az Yashir, this construct, which has got an Az with a future tense, is a special kind of reference to a special event, okay? Az, he's got a whole list there. I think the Radak actually sort of mentions all of this. If you just see the Radak, it's very small, I'm sorry, on the page. Those who have the blue books haven't got it, but I'll just read it very quickly. Az Tavona, the Radak says, Kamo Bao. It means that they came, these two women. Now I've got to take off my glasses for this. V'im Milat Az, Yavo Baro Vatid, B'mokom Avar. Az is followed by a future tense. It should be a past tense because it's talking about something that happened. But it's something always in the construct of the future. Kamo Az Yashir Moshe, Az Yashir Yisrael, Az Yavdil Moshe, Az Yidabei Yoshua, Az Yivnei Shlomo. The five Azes, which are very interesting. Upirish Az, what does it mean? Kaasher Shav Mi Givon. So the Radak puts the whole story into context. Shlomo just came back from Givon where he got that dream and the promises from God. Uvolo Yushalayim, and he comes back to Jerusalem. Bolo Zehadin Liado, this whole case, the judgment comes to him now. Nirata Bo Hamatana Tova, that we can see the great gift. Shenatana Kodesh Baruch Hu Chachma Ubina, that God gave him the tremendous sense of wisdom and understanding. So basically, the story now highlights the blessing which we read before. We read that Shlomo was given a bracha of chokhmah, of tremendous wisdom, and now the story proves it. Okay? And again, as I said, this is not necessarily going to be just chokhmah Torah, which we understand that Shlomo clearly had a deep awareness of, but it's also chokhmah teva, chokhmah various chokhmot. There's a scary chokhmah, which I believe that Shlomo was also very much aware of, which is called chokhmah partsu. To understand by the way a person looks. To look at a person's face, or to look at a person's overall, nowadays we call it body language. And to try and see what you're like. To try and see what's going on behind the scenes. And there are people who claim to do this. There was a Rebbe in Israel for many years, can't remember his name now, who really did analysis on this basis. I think he was actually a psychologist as well, but he was involved with the yeshiva and Keren B'Yavna, I think. And he used to do Chochmat HaParsuf, and the boys used to come back with kind of amazing stories about that. You know, things that he would just, by looking at you, he would sort of kind of deduce. Not sure if I'm really keen on that idea, but anyway, that's just by the by. So you can always... the reason I mention is because there's a suggestion that Shlomo may have had that particular... concept in this story as well. He could tell by looking at the faces what was going on, and that's clearly, let's use the wider term, looking at the body language. And clearly Shlomo was aware of this, even though he might not have called it what we call it today, it sort of has the same effect as you'll see. So again, we're looking at Pasuk Tet Zayin, page, I think, 21 in the blue books, and we'll just look at Psukim from here to the end of chapter 3. And you'll see it's a famous story. Az tavona shtaim nashim zonot el hamelech. Right? At that point, after Shlomo's come back to Yerushalayim, these two women zonot. Now the question is, what does it mean? Does it mean literally they're zonot, they're harlots, they're prostitutes, or what are they? That's the literal interpretation. There's a lot of midrashic text which suggests that these are especially sent by Hashem in the form of zonot. But really, they're angelic or otherwise, you know, they're coming from God to prove the point of Shlomo's wisdom.
Is that
yes.
The same? I think they use that term with what's the name? Rachav
Zonah. Yeah.
Do they use that term?
No, I think it's just being realistic. It uses it when the woman is, for want of a better word, prostitute, and it says so. Zonah. The rabbis play around with the word and say it's connected to the word mazon. And they say that she was really an innkeeper. She held had a tavern. Sorry?
These weren't innkeepers.
And these definitely were not innkeepers. You know, you can't really use that expression here. And there's a play around on trying to find a different meaning. But there's no question, it fits in perfectly to the context. These are two women who, let's put it this way, are not the most, caring mothers in the world. This is sort of unmarried mother's hostel that they live in, one assumes, or whatever it was in those days. And you know what? They have this problem with the child, and they come to the king. So I'm going to keep it simple, because, you know, once you go into midrashic territory, you're talking about a very unbelievable story.
If it's when you're dealing with these type of women, why would the king get involved with something of lower... I mean, these are really...
Right.
The
right. these are people at the bottom. And the answer is that, you know, that's a rule in the Torah, right? The king judges the rich and the poor together. I mean, there's no concept of financial status.
But what did Yisro tell Moshe? I mean,
you've got to have levels. You've got to have distinction. That's a good question. It seems that, you know, that might have just been a kind of series of circumstances that brought them right before the king. It could be that their whole argument was very close to the palace, and the king was new. And, you know, when you're new, you know, you'll still let the people in. Afterwards, we see that Shlomo was much more selective. It could be that, you know, this is, as you say, it's Beshed. This was meant to be the way it was meant to be. That's the Az, I think, Az Tavona. At that point, even though it normally may not have normally happened, but Az, especially to prove the point, that's why it happened. So I think that answers the question.
Recommended to Moshe, take most complicated cases for you.
Yeah.
Very, very complicated case. Nobody except for Shlomo could solve it.
Could solve it. So again, it's the idea of the complication. Yeah, I think so. There is clearly something here which is extremely challenging that nobody was prepared to make a commitment. Obviously, it was a very emotional case. Presumably, there was a lot of tears, there was a lot of screaming. You know, if you've ever been to a Beis Din, at the best of times, people shout at each other. It's very, very unbelievable what goes on. It's not like a court. You know, you come from the English court, where everyone's quiet and sitting there and very polite. You walk into a Beis Din, the first thing you do is scream. And the other guy screams back at you. And, you know, you've got this screaming match going on for it could be for a long time, for a short time. Then the Dayanim say, still? You know, like the famous sort of thing that one can imagine. And then they disappear and make their decision. And it's not really got the same format as a regular court case that we would be used to in a non-Jewish court. So it's just so interesting. Anyway, all right, let's get on with the case. So let's see what happened. So they come to the king and they stand before him. And now here comes woman number one. I'm going to sort of give them names, because I just want to try and make it a bit understandable. And I'll do that because I've got a page here which I want to show you with these names sort of put onto the various ladies. Now, Vatomo Isha Achat Biaduni, woman number one, who is, let's call her Leah, all right, for want of a better term. Leah says, Biaduni, please my master, and Iha Isha Zod, myself and this other woman, Rachel, right, so we've got Leah and Rachel. Myself and Rachel, Yoshvot b'bayit echa, we live in the same house, ve'eleid ima b'bayit, and I gave birth with her in the house. We both had children. All right? And that's the story. Leah's basically saying the following. Next passage, you'll see the actual circumstance. Vayhi b'yom ha'shlishi l'lidati. In other words, Leah says, I had a child on a Monday. Let's make it simple. 3 days later, on a Thursday, Vatelet Gamisha Zot, Rachel had a baby. So we were both together in this, presumably, whatever house it was. You know, sort of, as I said, kind of a hostel, whatever. Who knows? Maybe in a brothel. I mean, I just don't know, but I guess not. One assumes that they, you know, sort of were in a place where maybe they're a bit, you know, they have a certain amount of care going on here, certainly towards these babies, that they don't just sort of, as nowadays, you know, you give them up to social services. In those days, they didn't do that. So whatever scenario you want to put it in, the reality is that there are two women having babies, one on a Monday, and who's Leah, and Rachel is having her baby on a Thursday. V'anachnu yachta, and we are together, ein zar itanu babayit, there's nobody else with us in the house, Zulatish daim anachnu babayit, except the two of us. Now, what I think is interesting in this pasuk is that the information that we were alone, the only two of us, was told about b'yom ha'shlishi, the second birth. Think about it, because if you look at pasuk yudchet, vayhi b'yom ha'shlishi lelidati, and v'tele gamisha azot, in other words, on the third day, Leah says, after I gave birth, Rachel gave birth, and we were together alone. The implication was that on the first birth, on the Monday, when Leah herself gave birth, maybe they were not alone. Maybe there were other people in the house with them. All right? Because otherwise, this information to say that we are alone should have been said after the first birth and not after the second birth. The implication could very well be that in the first birth, there were a lot of people around. Who knows who was there? All right? But on the second birth, only the two of us and nobody else.
There might have been midwives, both women, and after the second woman gave birth, the midwives left.
And the midwives, it could be that they had to give birth, you know, they had to help each other to give birth. Right. That's all, I think, also the suggestion here. In other words, there may not have been midwives. Okay, maybe as basic as that. And they were helping each other. Now, this is a very dire situation, as you can imagine, but whatever it is, it's what it is. We'll read on. Look at Pasuk Yutet. That point, by the way, is really important, and we're going to come back to that in a few minutes. Pasuk Yutet, what happened? Vayamad ben Isha zod Laila. Now, the son of this woman died. Who's talking? Leah, the first woman to give birth. So she's saying that the son of Rachel, who gave birth on the Thursday. Again, Leah gave birth on the Monday, Rachel gave birth on the Thursday. Okay? And now Leah is saying that the woman who gave birth on the Thursday, Rachel, her son, died. Asher shachva alav, he was smothered by the mother. The mother smothered the child while she was lying on him. Obviously it was Vishoge, didn't do it on purpose for obvious reasons. And nevertheless, the baby died. So what did Rachel, the second mother, do? She got up at night, and she took my child, she took Leah's baby away, and she switched the children. Your maidservant, me, Leah, I was still asleep. So she took my baby, and she switched, she put that child into her lap, and her dead child she gave to me, and I woke up in the morning and the baby was dead. So really what Leah is saying in no uncertain terms is that I want my child back. Okay, that's the claim. Now, does she really want the child back? Or does she not want the real mother to have the nachas of having the child? And not sure what the king is going to do about this. This is all very speculative. What exactly her motivation is for making this argument in court. You know, once you learn the Mishpat Shlomo, you realize it's not such a straightforward case. All right, there's a lot of nuances here. But Chof Aleph, let's see what happened. So I got up in the morning. I wanted to feed my child. He was dead. I took a look baboka in the morning, and I knew it wasn't my child. Now this, of course, nowadays is a different situation, and that's why they immediately put a band on the wrist, and you know all these things, because these, I know there were cases of this happening, children being switched in hospital. You know, there was a movie made of this not so long ago. So now the things are much, much more strict, and this whole case would never have been a problem today, because you would have done DNA testing or whatever, and you would have found out who's who. But in those days, you didn't have all that, right? So what are you going to do? The reality was, again, that Leah, who is claiming that Rachel is now in a position of having switched the children. Rachel was mother number two, Leah was mother number one, and Leah now says, you know what, I got up to feed the child, it wasn't my child, it was the other woman's child, I want my child back. But Toma Isha Acheret, so of course the other woman has to say something. Yeah?
Just a quick question. How does she know that the other one, Rachel, smothered the baby?
Yeah. How does she actually know? And of course, why it could have died for many reasons. Yeah, so clearly there is a motivation here, right? Maybe to say that, not that she wants to get the child back, it's hers. She doesn't want Rachel to have the satisfaction of having a live child when it could be that she smothered her own child. All right, so therefore that's why the people say the motivation here could be very nasty, to put it mildly. All right, and we're not looking at two women who are very friendly towards each other. They are particularly unfriendly towards each other. So as I said, there's a lot of speculation here about the circumstance and the sort of arguments that are being brought, which show beneath the surface, your point makes the point, that it's really a hatred more than a love of the child is not really what's going on. It's more a hatred of the other woman. All right, and of course Shlomo has now got to sort of weigh up all of the emotions that are flying around to try and decide who keeps the baby. It's very interesting. Okay, and that's why it becomes more complicated. As in any court case, you know, you have to sort of judge not only the facts, but you have to judge the nuances, right? And that's a really serious issue, and not always easy to do. Always amused when on the TV, these judges that are TV judges, they're always looking for the smile, always looking for the guy who's smirking, or they always try and sort of find something from the way the case is presented. In England, everything's much more straight-faced. When you see the barrister with his wig, you know, there's no indication from his looks as to what he's, you know, what's going on. I suppose you see it when the person is cross-examined, but, you know, the presentation of the case is much more straightforward and without all the nuances. But here, there are clearly nuances. I'm just going to sort of leave it at that. But let's read on. So the other woman now says, of course, Rachel has now got to speak, and she says, no. All she says is, my child is alive. Look, I'm holding the baby. The baby is alive. Your child died. In other words, that's what she's saying, that, you know, it wasn't me who laid on my child and switched the baby. Leah, you smothered your child. That's what she's arguing. The other woman says, no. So the exactly the opposite. My child is alive. Your child is dead. And they both spoke and one assumes at the same time. It got very hot and heated, and they were speaking in front of the king. Now, I just want to bring back that point that we've been talking about for the last few weeks. And you see that his name is not even mentioned here. It's always a Hamelech, Hamelech, Hamelech. Because in this case, he is now going to establish his credentials as Melech. These are laws which maybe go beyond the letter of what we would recognize as Jewish law, and becomes like a status, a symbol of malchus, of the kingship of Shlomo, that the whole world can look up to. Because this maybe is a decision which may have been original, it may not have been original. Alright? You may have heard of this from other places, who knows? But the reality is that this is something which, as Hamelech, as the higher or deeper dimension of what Shlomo represents, in the bigger picture, as we've spoken about before, that's the side of Shlomo that is making the decision. I want to make that clear. So look at Chaf Gimel. Vayomer Hamelech, Zot Amered Zeh B'nei Achai B'nei Chamei. So he sums up the whole case. This one says, my son is alive and your son is dead. But Zot Amered Lo, and the other one says, no. Your son is dead and my son is alive. In other words, he sums it up very, very, very succinctly. And at this point, he comes out with this unbelievable peshara. But it's not a peshara. Again, as melech, bring me a sword. And they went through it. They brought the sword. And the king said, you cut the live baby in two. Alright, in other words, you'll say to me, wait a minute, you can come to a much easier solution. It just, you know, the Torah gives you lists of values of children. The Torah says that this child is worth X amount and this adult is worth Y amount. You know, we've got what's called Erech, it's all Gemara about it. So why do you have to even go to this stage? Just divide up the value of the child in two halves. You know, it's like a talus which is being held by two people, essentially. They're fighting over the same object. Divide the value and there you go. But no, Shlomo wants to make a decision here which is going to be absolute. He's not looking for a compromise, he's looking for an absolute decision. So, and of course this again is very interesting. It's not necessarily the style of Halacha, but it's certainly the style of Shlomo. And I'm saying that, trying to be very careful with the fact that we're going outside the Gedder, outside the boundary of normal Halachic decision here. But look what he says. He says, cut the child in two, half to one and half to the other, and he wants to see the reaction. He's looking immediately at the women's reaction. So the woman whose child was the live one, in other words, the real mother, right? That she was so overcome with mercy for her child. She was prepared to give away the child rather than kill the child. That's a basic emotion, that it's something which Shlomo obviously was expecting, that the real mother would absolutely be prepared to give away the baby. V'hamet al tamitu, but do not kill it. V'zotamer, the other mother, who clearly was not the real mother, gam li gam lach lo yeh gezorot, it's not for you, it's not for me, you know, do what the king said and split the baby. Vayan HaMelech Vayomer, so the king said on the basis of this, he understood, and he said, and Vayan is like making a proclamation. Vayan is Vayanu Vayomri, right? So to announce. Vayomer, to nu laita yilud achai, give the real mother, the one who wanted to give away the baby, give it to her. Vahamet lo tamitu, but do not kill the child. He imo, this is the mother. Vayishmu kol Yisrael kol mishpat, et mishpat asher shafat HaMelech, and they heard the judgment of the king. And they were afraid. They all of a sudden became scared of him. They saw such incredible chachma, ki ra'u, because they saw ki chachmat elokim bekirbo, the wisdom of God was within him, la'asot mishpat, to do judgment. And that's the story as it is. As I said before, there is a nuance here which I just want to deal with, which is the question of halacha. In the end of the day, with all due respect, as they say, there has to be, in a case like this, a halachic alternative. And it doesn't seem to feature, or certainly doesn't seem to come out, as strongly as we would expect it to. Yeah, just send them around. What I want to just discuss with you, because it's very hard to be original about this, because everybody knows this story, and it's one of those famous stories, but I want to deal with the halachic aspect, because it's really quite fascinating. Yes, Michael, sorry.
Good question. It's not good to me anyway when he speaks.
Yeah.
No, it said Vatoma Ha'isha Shabanat Hai Elam Melech. Which one was it? Is it the first one?
We'll see. We're going to go through and try and work out who's speaking. It is extremely confusing. Over the years, I've been teaching this over and over again, and I've come to the conclusion that there is kind of a tremendous vague area. It's a grey area about the exact details, and I think the story is here not so much for the exact details, but much more for the effect. It's a story which has the most amazing effect. The idea that the king can decide who the real mother is, even if it doesn't become clear to us when we read the story who exactly is talking at the time, but the consequence of the story is what the story is about. And this is the idea of Shlomo's wisdom and sort of proving that, you know, he's been blessed with a tremendous amount of chokhmah. But we'll come to that in a second. Sorry, Abe first.
There's two things. Abe, yeah.
Well, hang on a second. Well, that's not clear. See, it depends how the painting is. See, on the painting that I have in my computer, they're coming in. One woman's holding the live charm, one was holding the dead charm, which is very interesting because it's not presented like that. The presentation over here would be, from what I would understand, is that one woman is coming in holding a baby, a live baby, and the other woman is holding nothing. All right, that's the way that I understand it. But as I said, you know, different painters over the years have presented this in different ways. It's very interesting. Well, it could be the baby's sort of like, you know, in a bassinet or whatever in the middle there, and they're arguing over the charm. But we're gonna make a suggestion here about chazokah, which is, you'll say to me, motzvah may not apply. This comment that we have makes an assumption that one of them is holding the charm, which I suppose, in terms of the way the story seems to play out, would fit into the circumstance. It may not be the only way to learn it. As I said, the details are very, very sort of, you know, it's kind of fuzzy. Because it's not about the detail, it's about the consequence. I think that I really want to make that point, because I think it's important. But saying that, we'll get into a bit of detail. Look at this. What I gave you is taken from a commentary called The Riff. This is not The Riff on the Talmud. This is a gentleman called Rabbi Yaakov. I got the name wrong here. His name is Pidunki. Rabbi Yaakov Pidunki, I don't know who he was, and there's a manuscript of his commentary which is added to the Abarbanel. It's at the bottom, called the Riff. It's on every page of Abarbanel's commentary, more or less, there's a little paragraph at the bottom from this gentleman. They found a manuscript. My guess is that he's probably a contemporary of the Riff and of the Abarbanel 1400s in Spain. And it was a manuscript that was lost for many, many years. And it was found and put into an edition of the Abarbanel that came out in Israel probably about 30, 40 years ago. So the history of this, I don't know. But this gentleman really does make some interesting reading here. Listen to this. Vatoma Isha, I'm just going to work our way through this very quickly. Vatoma Isha Acha, Bi Adoni, Yesh Lishol, top on the right-hand column. Eich lo posak Shlomo Hadin, Hamotze Mechavel of Arayim. Why didn't Shlomo decide the halacha that if one of the women is holding the child, possession is 9/10 of the law? So you'll say to me, but wait a minute, do we do this with live creatures, as it were? Do you say such a thing? Normally that's about a talid, it's about an inanimate object. So he says, yeah, we do. He says, v'kivan sha'achad mechzeket bevlan. Since one of the women was holding on to the child, he maintains that there was absolutely one of them. He imo, she's the mother, says an easy solution. Rachel is standing there holding the baby. Leah is standing there claiming that the baby is hers. So who's the mother? Rachel, she's holding the baby. Period. That's the end of discussion. Where do I know this from? He says, look in the Gemara Bechoro, Perek Be'en. Chad Shehif Kid Teleh Chai Eitzah Balabayin. Two people, Reuben and Shimon. So what did Shimon do? Shimon had a Teleh Chai, he had a live animal which he deposited with to Reuben. He left it with Reuben. V'yeshta balabai teleh achet. And Reuben has another animal. So now Reuben's got two. He's got his own, and he's got one, which was a deposit from Shimon. Umet echad mehem. One of the animals dies. And obviously, difficult to tell which one was which. There was no siman. Hare, then what happens? Hamafkid motzim echavera v'olov araya. Umoelet cheskas balabai. In other words, whose animal died, the Reuven is holding the two animals, can claim the one that died was Shimon. You know what? I'm holding on my animal, which I've had since it was born. You gave me yours for a deposit. The Chazokah establishes, the holding of the live animal establishes that Reuven is holding it, is the owner, and the animal that is alive is Reuven's. The animal that died, therefore, is Shimon's. That's the way the Gemara decides the case. Afal pi she'toein sofek, even though they claim there's a doubt, it's the decision that the Gemara makes. So therefore, v'nira l'anias dati, imadomer b'tosfus, v'perek ha'shoya, the Gemara, the Tosfus also discusses this in Gemara Bava Metzia, the tama d'hosam havi mishum she'ya muxak balabai b'tileh chai me'ikara. He was holding on to the animal from its birth. The Reuven, who had the original animal, together with the deposit animal, the original animal, he held from the moment the animal was born. It was in his possession. In which case, now, if that's the case, I can ask the question about these women. The woman is trying to extract the baby from the other one. So according to his interpretation of the story, Leah, as I said, is the one who's doing the talking, saying that this is my child that Rachel is holding. Leah had the baby on Monday, Rachel had the baby on Thursday. And the question therefore is, if Rachel is holding the baby and Leah is claiming the child, then Rachel can turn around and say, like in the case of the animal here, I've been holding on to this child from the moment it's been born, it's mine. And you know what, Shlomo Melech, you can go and read some Vand, you can do whatever you want, but this is the way it is. And Shlomo would have had to respect that. So the question is, why not? Now listen to this, very smart this. I know I'm turning into a bit of a shir here in terms of a Gemara shir, but it sort of plays into the whole story. It's an interesting twist. So again, Hamotziya mechaverta bi adoni, she says, oh my master, ani veshazod yoshua b'vayt echad, we're both sitting in the same house, ve lady ma b'vayt, and we both had a baby in the same place. And on the third day, in other words, I had a child on Monday, and on the Thursday, Lelidati, after I gave birth, Leo's talking, but Telet Gamesha Zod, Rachel also gave birth. And we're both alone in the house. And remember, I pointed out that phrase is only mentioned after the second birth and not after the first birth. So says Rav Padanki the following. Vakashi says, I don't understand. The ain't say the ketuvim alonu. These psukim seem to be out of chronological order. Shekachoy l'loma b'techila. What he should have said, what Leah should have said, ani v'sha azod yoshvot b'bayit echad, we're both in the same house, v'anachnu yachdav, and we were together, ain zaritano. Just mentioned that we were alone from the beginning. In other words, not only on Thursday were we alone, but we were alone on Monday. Why didn't she say that? And then they lady ma babait, and we both had babies. You know, I had it on Monday, she had it on Thursday. Why did she not present the information like that? She only waited to tell us about being alone after the second birth, but not after the first. Yeah.
Because if there were people at the first birth, they would recognize the baby.
Excellent. And this is what we're going to say. Now listen to this. He says, Vayihi bayom agimel, on the third day, v'teled gam isha azod, this woman gave birth, v'lom alo hiske sho yachta babait, ein zaritam. It's only mentioned after the Thursday birth that they were alone, but not after the Monday. Now, l'chein ani omer. This is where the Rav is talking here. He says, I have to say, ani omer. I once remember a wonderful shir in the yeshiva where the Rosh Yeshiva came. He's still alive, wonderful man, Baruch Ezrachi. Baruch is one of really the old Rosh Yeshivas now in Eretz Yisrael, in Yerushalayim. And he once stood up and he said this fantastic svar in front of the yeshiva, this wonderful piece of logic. So one of the boys had the chutzpah to say, who says that? You know, as if to say, where did you get it from? So he stood and he said, he picked himself up like this and he says, Ichzog, I say. And that was the end of the discussion. It's wonderful, you know, it's just a magic moment when he was destroyed the argument. This boy was really trying to get an argument going, and the Rosh Yeshiva just absolutely destroyed it. It was wonderful. And he says over here, like, this reminds me, L'chach ani omer, says Rav Padangi. He said, I'm going to say the following. You want to argue with this? Gesunta hate, but this is what I believe. Shezot o'esha natna ta'am l'shelata. This woman, Leah, that we're talking about, the first woman, now explains her request. Kadei shelo yodunu din ze lomash shehavlad b'cheskas ha-mukhsebo v'motzi olav haraya. That's why she's saying what she's saying, because she wants to do away with the possibility of Hamotzi Mechaveh Olav Haraya applying it. She doesn't want the halacha to apply the way it normally would. Now, how does Leah do that? Think about this for a second. She says, on the Monday when I gave birth, a whole bunch of people were with me in the house. So that means that my birth was verified, as Lenny said, by a whole bunch of people. There's an absolute validity to my birth. On Thursday, when Rachel gave birth, how many people were with her?
Just one.
Just the other woman. So who gave...
Two people.
Well, her... The baby. Hang on a second. So what he's saying is, or what he's trying to put into the mouth of Leah, is that Leah is now a bit of a Talmudist. This is the problem with this argument. But it turns out that she's a bit of a Talmudist. Why? Because she will then turn around and say... Who established the facts of the second birth wasn't anybody from the outside, it was only me. Well, you know what? I come along, if I said that she had a baby, and I claim that the baby died, I am the one who established the birth in the first place of the second woman. So I can now come along and dictate the circumstance. You know what happened? The woman had the birth, the second birth, and I'm the only one that can tell you for sure that she had the baby. I think the assumption is that the dead baby is not there. Could very well be. Maybe she's even saying that there could even be a doubt whether she gave birth at all. Who knows? But she claims that this child, Rachel claims the child is hers. You know what? The whole circumstance of Rachel even having a claim is because I was the only one to witness that she had a baby in the first place. So you know what? The Gemara says an expression, Pesha asa, Pesha etir. I'm the one who created the situation of the birth, of attributing the birth to the second mother. So I can come along now, she claims, and say that even though Rachel is holding the baby, it's not hers. Because it could very well be that the facts are that this baby is really mine. And you know what? In halacha, she has a claim. She has a way of doing this. I don't know if the point is clear, but it's a very technical point of the person who generates the information is the one who can literally dictate the circumstance. There is this concept, and it's a halachic concept. Just follow the text a minute, and I just want to show you this insight. So he says where there's an asterisk in the middle of the column there. Lochach diktecha devareha. She was very careful about what she said, Leah. Lomar v'anachnu yachta v'enzari tanu b'leidat isha ashniya. She mentions the fact they were alone only at the second birth. V'inyanhu, what's the whole story? Because she yaldai isha rishona, because when Leah gave birth the first time on a Monday, hayu kama b'nei adam ita b'bayin. Because the suggestion is that when the first woman gave birth, there was a whole party going on there. Who knows what was happening there? V'ra'ua b'not ki yalda ben. And everybody saw that she had a baby. Leah. Everybody knew that Leah had given birth. They already sort of named the baby or whatever they did. Who knows what they did? They made a kiddush. It's all established. Aval beledet aisha shnia. When Rachel, the second woman, gave birth, lacha gimul yomim hayushteim yachdav ein zaritam. Nobody else was with them in the house. But often shelo tuchzak la velad bifnei abriot. That means that nobody knew about the existence of the child. There was no established evidence that this child even existed. Rak hi yada b'leidat chaverta. Only that Leah knew about it. Leah was the only one who knew. And she had a ben, had a child. Ulezek hivna devareh. That's why Leah said what she said. V'yamran, she says, because Leah doesn't want motzi mechaverta to apply it. V'teilet gam isha hazot. That's why Leah says that this second woman also had a baby on a Thursday. V'anachu yachdav, and at that point we were alone. Ein zaritanu zulat shtayim anachu, except we, us, ourselves alone, babayin. Lomar, to say, shebeledet chaverta, when Rachel gave birth, lo hayashum echad shera'a ota yoledet ben Nobody saw it except me. Now, according to this, think about it. The first woman, Leah, has got an established evidence from a whole bunch of people that she had a baby, whereas Rachel's evidence that she even had a baby was only established by Leah. So Leah is coming along to say that even though Rachel is holding the child, that is not acceptable evidence. Possession, in that case, is not 9/10 of the law. You know what? Leah says, I can extract the child on this, or at least I can say, Hamotze Mechaver Alav Araya will not be the obvious solution here. Yeah.
Can't you be saying, Hamotze Mechaver Alav Araya, I'm giving you a Raya, she's holding the baby,
yes.
And I'm giving you the proof that it's mine.
That it's mine. Well, what? Of course, this is what she's trying to say, that because of the doubt of the circumstance, Shlomo, don't apply a motzi mechaver. My argument would extract the baby from the mother, but I know you're tempted to say, because she's holding the child, that should be the sign of who she is. In other words, what Leah does is creates the doubt. And like in court, right? Once you create the reasonable doubt, then everybody is stuck. All right, and you know what to do. And that's why Shlomo in the end says, well, bring me an eye. I can't apply halacha in this case. I can't remotely go through the rules of a motzi mechaver alav araya, because you know what? This is not a normal case of chazaka. It's not a normal case. And therefore, in such a case, this Rav Pikundi wants, Pedinka, whatever his name is, wants to suggest, you know what? We're not following halachic guidelines in this case. We have to go for the bigger, more dramatic sort of solution. Bring me the sword and let's see what happens next. Yeah.
Couldn't she also argue chazaka? For the first 3 days, she was the only one with the baby.
Yeah, I mean, that would be... it would be a strong argument to give her the benefit of extracting the child. So the argument that then, of course, is, but the other woman says, still, she claims that my possession is my possession. All right, it's a stalemate because she's holding the baby. The reality is, with all the arguments that Leah has, Rachel is still holding the baby. So who's going to be proven the mother? So Shlomo has to say, you know what, bring the sword and let's see who the real mother is. And it could very well be, you know what, Rachel could be the real mother. And it could very well be that Leah's not the real mother. But Leah is doing this, as we said, as Michael pointed out, because of the fact that she's got another agenda here. She's not being very nice. You know, these are not very friendly people, these two ladies. They don't seem to, how should we say, I mean, they might have helped each other to give birth, but I suppose, you know, what are you going to do? You're not going to leave the woman in that circumstance. And basically, this is what he wants to point out here. Look at what I've written on the side here. Leah's the Isha Rishana, just to show you the diagram, because I think we've seen enough on the text. Leah's the first woman, Rachel is the second woman. So the case, Leah gave birth on a Monday, Rachel gave birth on a Thursday. So Leah claims that Rachel's baby died, and Rachel took her baby instead. That's the claim. Now Rachel is mukzeket, she's holding on to the child. Leah claims the child back, she wants to get the child back, and that's the case as the way he presents it. So D, Rachel counter-argues, right, the live baby is mine and Leah's baby died. So this is the stalemate that we've got. So Leah agrees to division of the child. Rachel wants the child to live, even with Leah. And of course, this is the suggestion that, in fact, the real mother may very well be the woman who is holding the baby. But Shlomo says, how am I going to decide? I can't just decide by possession, which is a halachic device which we normally would use. I'm going to have to decide with a special chokhmah, which is probably only once in Jewish history has ever been tried. And the principle is established, I suppose after that you can then apply the principle if necessary, but never bring a sword and try and do this. Do not try this at home, it's dangerous. And F, Rachel is declared the true mother. Maybe, I put that maybe because it's not clear who the real mother is, because you know what, it doesn't really matter. The principle here is not about who, what, where, but it's about the application. How Shlomo really goes about this. And of course, the question at the bottom, why isn't Chazaka decisive here? And it can become Rachel's baby automatically because she's holding the child. And then this is the riff that we just saw, who I think really lays it on the line and says, you know what? Chazaka here will just produce a tremendous stalemate as was produced anyway. Chazaka is not going to solve the problem. It's going to make the problem more complicated. And Shlomo decided, not going to do chazakas. You know what? We're going to have to go for something completely different. Bring me a sword. Unbelievable. Yeah.
Rashi clearly doesn't agree with your...
Yeah, I'm sure he doesn't.
Right. And even if you don't invoke Vaskol here, it wouldn't be, if it was just a maybe that he applies this divine justice, it wouldn't have the dramatic effect of, it's got to be the mother, that everyone agrees this was the mother.
Yes.
It has to be verified.
Yeah. I hear what you're saying. I throw this out to you, and I'm pleased you come back and said, it's not so glad, because you're right. The reality is that whichever way you look at this story, I had a number of purposes in this share. Number one, that we all know the story, but when we learn the story, we realize it's not so straightforward. All right, that's point number one. Point number two is really to try and tie in a sort of Jewish angle, a halachic angle, into the story, even if it doesn't work so well, and to see that the Mefarshim are really as perplexed about it in so many ways as we are. But the bottom line of it, the wisdom of Shlomo, that's very clear. And Melech, 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 all the way through. This is his decision as king. This is a decision which is a majestic decision. Phenomenal thing. Yes?
Yeah, but look, is it possible to understand the style of today's American life?
Yes.
Maybe it's not clear who is the real mother, but it's clear who is the better woman.
Who is the better woman?
So he wants...
And he's made that decision, right? And he's come to the point of deciding who is going to be the better person to look after the child. That's a very interesting approach. And in other words, not going for the very simple solution, right, of who the real mother is, but who will be the better person to take on the responsibility. That's very interesting. Didn't think of it like that. And that's a yicholion. It's possible. And that, of course, I mean, that will fit in beautifully, because I'm going to argue all the way through now that Shlomo was 2,000 years ahead of his time, because in chapter 4 next week we're going to see Shlomo's government, and he has a government which will be in Washington, will be phenomenal, and he's written about here 2,500 years ago, right? He has Minister of Defense, he has Minister of Finance, he's got it all, right? He's even got the religion, he's even got religion and state, which in this country would be really forbidden. I mean, it's not allowed, but he's put it in there because you've got to. This is Israel. It's not America, but doesn't matter. He's got a marechet. He's got a framework here. Shlomo is phenomenally ahead of the game on everything. According to Chazal, I think they even suggest he invented the motor. He actually, the way they describe it, it seems to be some sort of in physics. He put a machine that could move. I think that's the way the mechona metaltelet, I think they call it, something like that. Nowadays, we know what a moving machine is. All right, we all have to sort of sit in them for a long time every day. And that's the deal. But Shlomo seems to have known the wisdom behind it. It's very fascinating. Yes, Sidney.
The Pasuk Kaf Gimel, I keep looking at it, and it says, Yom HaMelech, and it seems, doesn't say who, which mother said what, but they're saying the opposite.
Yeah.
According to Shlomo, the first one says, Zed Niyakai, the son is in Lim, Niyakar, B'nai Hamais.
Yeah, and your son is there. My life, son.
In other words, both of them didn't say, he's not saying they're both saying the same thing. One's saying, her child died and mine's alive, and the other one's saying, her died and mine's alive. The terminology is different.
It's turning around.
That, Shlomo had some sense of what each one was claiming, that there was something going on.
Something going on here, right.
So that's, because why else would.
Right, because it gets switched around.
We repeat again.
Yes.
What the story is, unless Shlomo said, you can see one person said it this way and one person.
Right, right, and therefore that's it, and he wants to sort of, and therefore he has to sort of.
And he said there's something on my mind, and then just based on their claim, we'll be able to get out.
Yeah, and we'll get out the decision. Excellent, excellent. That's a tremendous deal, and that's exactly. I see what you're saying, because it's put in the. It's like a mirror image, chiastic. It sort of goes, ABC, CBA, it's sort of working that way. Very interesting. Yeah?
This reminds me of some logic problems when you have people lie and tell the truth.
Yes.
And you're supposed to ask a question to find out who's actually telling the truth.
And that's what's going on here. Yeah, he'd be great on the radio, he'd be great on TV. He'd be wonderful. I mean, sort of a moderator. Imagine him doing a political debate. I mean, it'd be wonderful. But he'd probably bring a sword and probably chop them all. I mean, he wouldn't stand for any of these guys. I'm not going to say that. You're on tape. Yes.
Around 5 years ago, Sharon's publicist compared the whole thing with Yerushalayim to this with the babies.
Oh, really?
He said, we Jews are losing the battle.
Yeah.
Because the Arabs are saying it, but it all belongs to us, and we're saying cut it in half.
And we're saying cut it in half. Very interesting. I've never heard that, but that's very interesting. Wow. And even more so now at the moment. Look what's going on again. All over again. Yeah, Lenny, you'll have the last word.
The second woman says, Zosmer's Gamli, Gamlach, Loya, Zor. What exactly does that mean? What is she saying?
Well, in other words, that as far as she is concerned, the baby should be cut in half. You're not going to get it, and I'm not going to get it. She's prepared to forego.
What I'm saying, but isn't that telling? That's a giveaway. I mean, his woman says, cut him in half. No mother would say that.
Right, right, right. That's
so, so I don't understand why this people saying, well, is this the mother, that the mother? The woman who said, give the other woman is the mother. The woman who says, cut her hair, is obviously not the mother.
Right, right. And therefore everybody argues, what is such a great chokhmah about what's going on? All right, you know, if you take the question to the next limit.
Well, I think the chokhmah is in the logic of taking the knife.
Taking the knife, and that's the answer. But in terms of the actual sort of the emotions that are expressed as a result of the knife, it's obvious. It's so obvious that you say in that there's no chokhmah. But the chokhmah was to go to the point of, you know, bringing the showdown, high noon. He brought it to a crescendo. And that's where the chokhmah is, and you're absolutely right. And I think that's the case. But whichever way you look at it, as I said, it's so much about the consequence of the whole thing, which is really the incredible outcome of this.
It's psychological. It's psychological to see how people mind think, you know.
And their reaction. And he looked at their faces, and he looked at their body language. Everything went into this. And Shlomo, you know, at such a young age, I mean, he's not more than what, I don't know, 13, 14 at this point. If that, and he's exhibiting a tremendous sense of awareness, of human awareness. He knows that, you know, he's really, really ahead of the game. And I think that's why this is such a great story, and I'm not going to dwell on it. We could spend sort of weeks on this because of all different scenarios that you could come up with, but I think the principle of the whole thing is so beautiful, that this is a person who really takes everything to a new level, everything. And of course, the problem is that he's going to take certain laws in the Torah to a new level, 1,000 wives, thousands of horses, and who knows what. And that's where the problem starts. The issue with Shlomo is going to be gevulim. How do you fix the boundaries? And the boundaries are going to be very challenging, as we'll see already from Mitzvah Hashem next week when we learn Perek Dalet. I think at that point, we wish everybody good evening. Thank you so much. Thank you.